This is The Full Story. I'm Rebecca Saran in for Ron Ropiak. It's a hot topic question that many doctors, psychologists, and even parents have discussed. What is the appropriate age to give a child their own cell phone or personal computer device like an iPad? Some experts say the average age of kids getting a cell phone is about 10 to 11. Some experts also say that, unfortunately, there are no hard guidelines. Dr. Dimitri Christakis is one of the experts on our show today. He is director of the Center for Child Health, Behavior, and Development at Seattle Children's Research Institute, a pediatrician at Seattle Children's Hospital, and professor in the School of Medicine at the University of Washington. And he has dedicated himself to answering the question of what effect is digital media having on the brains and development of our children? He was the moderator of an event organized by Children and Screens Institute of Digital Media and Child Development in partnership with Stony Brook University in May that promoted our conversation today. Children and Screens is an international nonprofit organization founded in 2013 that is dedicated to exploring media's impact on child development. Doctor, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the brain's development in the early years. This is a crucial period for growth, isn't it?
Well, it is. You know, we're born with our brains not fully developed, and in fact, our minds are fine-tuned to the world in which we inhabit. And the most pronounced period of growth is early. In fact, the newborn brain triples in size in the first 2 years of life. But it's important to note that the brain is not fully developed until late adolescence, early adulthood, until about the age of 23, 24. And the last part of the brain to develop is the prefrontal cortex. It's right below your forehead, and it's the area that kind of controls what we think of as executive function, the highest order thinking. And that's not developed in teenagers, and it's one of the reasons that teenagers can be very impulsive. Sometimes we describe them as vehicles that have gas pedals but no brakes.
Well, when we look at screen time use and we look at, say, a young person in the 1970s versus a child today in 2019, tell us the difference in the amount of time each of those kids spent looking at a screen.
Yeah, it's quite dramatic, actually. You know, it starts with the age at which they begin to interact with screens. So in 1970, the average age at which children began to watch television, which was really the only medium at the time, was about 4.5 years of age. And today, it's 4 months of age. So the typical child today in the United States begins regularly using a screen at 4 months of age. And the typical preschool child today spends about 4.5 hours in front of a screen of some kind. That's if you total screen time at home with screen time in daycare settings, where most of children in the United States spend at least part of their day. So 4.5 hours a day, and they're only awake for about 12 hours. So they're spending a third of their waking hours as preschool children in front of a screen of some kind. By the time they're adolescents, they're spending about 8 hours a day on a screen of some kind. And again, there they're typically awake for, well, they should be only awake for at most really 14 to 16 hours. So they're spending, again, about 50% of their time on a screen of some kind. It's really remarkable how much time they spend, and begs lots of questions about if that time is well spent, and what the effects of all that screen time, what the effects it's having on their cognition, on their social development, on their behavior, et cetera.
So let's talk about the impact on brain development then. That much time in front of a screen, even for a toddler, 4.5 hours, that's a lot of time. How does it impact brain development?
Well, you know, in many ways, I like to think of there being sort of two essential pathways that determine how media affects all of us, frankly, regardless of age. One is what I call the direct pathway. And the direct pathway is mediated by the experience itself. So how does what I'm watching or what I'm doing on a screen affect my development and behavior? And that's largely dependent on the content, right? So if I'm playing a violent video game, it's going to have a different effect than if I'm playing an educational game, or if I'm FaceTiming with friends, it's going to have a different effect than if I'm watching an entertainment or sexualized content of some kind. So that's the direct pathway, and it exists across all ages. And then there's the other one, which is what I call kind of the indirect pathway, and that's mediated primarily through displacement, which is to say, during this time that I'm on a screen, or during those times that I'm on a screen, what am I not doing? What experiences are being pushed out as a result of my choosing to do this activity, right? Because there are only so many hours in a day, everything you do comes at the expense or the potential expense of something else. So the reason those two pathways are important is because even if we decide that there are healthy and good things that a child can do on a screen, it's entirely possible to do too much of a good thing or to be doing a good thing at the wrong time. So even an educational game that has value, if you're doing it during dinner time or during meal time, what you're missing out on is that opportunity to have real, incredibly important conversations with your siblings and with your caregivers.
And also the content on screens, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to move at a much faster pace than typically happens in the real world. And what does that do to brain stimulation?
Yeah, so this is one of the concerns we've had for quite a while in my lab, which is essentially what we've called the overstimulation hypothesis. And what that is based on is just what you said, the pacing of a lot of digital media content. So if you think about it, our brains evolved over millennia, and they evolved to process things that happen in real time, right? Because every experience we have in the real world, by definition, happens in real time, regardless of what it is. It wasn't really until the advent of media, and not even when media first came out, right? Television was invented in the 50s, and most of what was on television was live action. So it was shows like Captain Kangaroo or talk shows, things that really happened in real time. But over time, things have been sped up considerably so that when you watch a program, certainly when you watch many of the programs that are designed for young children, the pacing is surreal. It happens in a way that cannot happen in real life. And so when we think about how that our brains are fine-tuning themselves to the world in which they inhabit, the hypothesis that we've had for some time in my lab is that if you expose the developing brain to too much of this very fast-paced programming, it preconditions the mind to expect that high level of input. And then reality becomes kind of boring by comparison. It doesn't happen fast enough. I've developed a brain that expects things to happen as fast as they happen or they can happen on a screen or in a video game, and I'm disappointed by the pace with which the real world unfolds. It leads to fundamentally to shorter attention spans and to boredom. And a lot of parents see this. A lot of teachers, frankly, report it as being a problem. And we tested that in a series of studies that we did, and we found it, in fact, to be the case, that the more television children watch in the first 3 years of their life, the more likely they are to have attentional problems at school age.
So could this be taken as far as perhaps too much screen time could lead to conditions like ADHD?
It could. In the studies we did, we measured attentional capacity. We didn't make a clinical diagnosis of ADHD. But, you know, I should point out that that's really what matters. I mean, ADHD is a clinical diagnosis, but the truth is we know from decades of research that a child's ability to attend, regardless of whether or not they meet the threshold criteria for ADHD, makes an enormous difference, not just in their school performance, which seems fairly obvious to most parents, fairly intuitive, but to their life performance. They're more likely to graduate high school, more likely to be happily married, less likely to use substances, more likely to be gainfully employed, et cetera, et cetera.
Doctor, how much of this is an evolution of the species? That from caveman forward, we have evolved and adapted to our environment and the changing times, and we're just in a new world today, and this is part of the evolution?
Well, I think there is clearly a cultural evolution, right? When you talk about evolution, historically, it happened at glacial, and I use that term quite literally, paces. So environmental shifts that happened, which they did, happened typically incrementally. Now, there were clearly some catastrophic alternatives to that, right? Meteors could strike, or the dinosaurs, for example, went extinct, one theory posits, because a meteor struck the Earth, and the climate changed dramatically, and dinosaurs couldn't survive. But most of evolution is explained through small changes that require incremental adaptations over a long period of time. That's not what we have here. We've introduced media at an incredibly rapid pace. In fact, for most of us that are studying it, we're always two steps behind the technology that's being introduced. So, as an example, the iPad, which most of us can't imagine a world without, has only been around for 10 years. And for those of us trying to study the impact of touchscreen technologies on children, it takes us at least 10 years to get funding, conduct research, mm-hmm. analyze our findings, and submit them for publication. In the meantime, new technologies are already on the horizon and are going to be introduced any day now.
It's a lot to keep up with. I know you're continuing your research. We want to thank you for joining us today. Now we're focusing more on the cognitive, social, and sleep side. We know that excessive screen time is an issue for young developing minds, but what exactly happens to their brains or their social skills? Joining us now is Dr. Lauren Hale, professor of family, population, and preventive medicine at Stony Brook University and founding editor-in-chief of Sleep Health, Journal of the National Sleep Foundation. Her research focuses on the correlation between screen time and sleep habits, and she says that nearly 90% of teens are not getting the sleep they need to function at their best, and 96% of older teens have an electronic device in their bedroom. All right. Dr. Hare, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Okay, let's talk about sleep and screen time. Why don't we just start with the numbers I just mentioned. Teenagers obviously are affected by screen time and their sleep.
Absolutely. Common Sense Media issued a report in April, or maybe May, with some high numbers about screens and sleep, and they show that over a third of teens actually report waking up to check their mobile devices in the middle of the night. So screens are not only a problem with going to bed and falling asleep, but sort of new findings are revealing that they also interrupt sleep because people are so attached to their phones that they want to see what's going on in the middle of their sleep.
Before we get to the impact of the screens on sleep or go further with that, let's just talk about the difference between sleep in a child versus sleep in an adult. I know it can vary from child to child, but in general, are there big differences?
Certainly, there are differences in sleep architecture as children age in terms of the timing of sleep, how much is expected to sleep, and the types of sleep that they're getting over the night. But I like to make the point that all people from birth through late adulthood need sufficient restorative sleep for the optimal daytime functioning. And so while, of course, there are specific differences and developmental differences of sleep over the life course, any message that I have for you or your children on how to reduce the adverse impact of screens on sleep should apply not only to your children, but to you, because you can also benefit from these thoughts.
Well, you mentioned the restorative aspect of sleep. I mean, this is when our body really heals itself, cleans itself out. It's crucial to our overall health, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So tell me what goes on. We see toddlers today with touchpads, screen pads. What effect does that have on their minds and their sleep habits?
So in the last 10 years or so, been literally dozens, if not hundreds of studies showing the adverse association of screen use either across the day, in which children are using 9-10 hours of screen time a day, or at bedtime using screens as a substitute for reading, on sleep outcomes. The most common sleep outcome that is observed in these findings is that sleep duration is shortened, so shorter sleep time overall, because the screen use itself is pushing back bedtime. So kids who are using screens in the evening use them well into the bedtime hours, sometimes, or frequently rather, they bring them into their bedroom. Sometimes, and especially now with tablets and mobile phones, they bring them into their bed, and it pushes bedtime back, shutting the lights off back, and subsequently delays their sleep onset. So sleep shortening is probably the biggest effect, but we're also seeing effects on sleep quality. It's reducing the self-reported quality of sleep, and it's also affecting sleep efficiency, which refers to how often they're waking up in the night, or sleep fragmentation, because of this issue of checking your phone in the middle of the night in case something important happens. So those are the primary mechanisms. I think for teenagers, it's really important to remember that most teenagers, unfortunately, go to high schools that start well before the American Academy of Pediatrics recommended start time of 8:30. So they are having to wake up quite early for their body clock. Their natural body clock wants them to stay up a little later and sleep in a little later. And so they're staying up, aided by these digital technologies, and they're having to wake up earlier. So they're being crunched on both ends in a way that's really quite bad for their well-being.
Why is this different, the iPad, the cell phone, why is this different from television viewing? Why did that not...
It's a great question. And I will say there was a lot of research on the effects of television on sleep and well-being years ago, and we're still concerned about that. But this added aspect of tablets or iPhones being interactive. So television watching is, for the most part, a passive activity. You turn it on in the background. You don't have to pay attention to it. You can turn it off easily. It's reasonably far away from your face. But looking at your phone, engaging in social media, or playing a video game, whether it's on a tablet or in on a device closer to your face, it can be quite stimulating. It's very interactive, and it's psychologically stimulating. And the blue light that is emitted from most of these devices suppresses melatonin, and melatonin is sleep-promoting. So you've got all three of these factors. The three factors are time displacement, stimulating content, and the effects, the alerting effects of blue light working together to interfere with a regular healthy sleep routine and falling asleep easily.
All right. At this point, I'd like to bring in Dr. Letitia Nagel. She's a professor of psychological sciences at UConn, director of UConn's Cognitive Science Program, and director of the school's developmental program and head of UConn Kids. She joins us today via Skype. Dr. Nagel, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
What are you seeing in your research regarding, I mean, we just heard what Dr. Hale was talking about in terms of these various aspects that screen time, cell phones, iPads has on sleep. What are you seeing in your research?
Well, so first I should say that that I think Dr. Hale's research on sleep and cell phones, et cetera, is really cool and spot on. What I have looked at in both in my research and in the research of others in the field is more about the content of the cell phone games, the video games, the rather than the degree to which they help them go to sleep or not help them go to sleep.
Well, I would think the content, if it is very fast paced, it would be an either further deterrent to sleep. And so the content does have something to do with sleep as well, doesn't it?
Yes, of course.
Absolutely. And I agree completely that content is one of the key factors that can interfere with sleep. A perfect example is a teenage girl on social media looking at pictures of what her friends are doing, and she's wondering to herself, where are they? How come I wasn't invited? Do they like me? What does this mean? And all of those perfectly normal thoughts about social exclusion,
FOMO,
ruminating about, are going to make it very difficult for her to fall asleep at night. And this type of thing happens again and again. And if you just didn't look at your phone, you might be better able to sleep and have a better day the next day because of it.
Yeah, Dr. Nagels, it's an excellent point about this fear of missing out or exclusivity that that Dr. Hale just mentioned.
Right. So I think the research that I'm more plugged into has to do with the degree to which these kinds of video games and educational games actually support their academic progress, rather than the degree to which they impair their sleep, which I'm not quarreling with at all. But what the studies suggest is that kids, you know, school age kids, preschool kids who engage in active learning, in engaging games, in meaningful games, and in socially interactive games are the ones who show gains in academic learning, who show gains in executive function, that is, in being able to control their thoughts, and in the real little kids, in vocabulary and interest in academic subjects overall. This is all, you know, this is different from the degree to which it impairs their sleep, which I'm not quarreling with. This is just suggesting that the games played strategically at strategic times during the day with supportive parenting can nonetheless be advantageous for children, you know, not in huge amounts, but in small doses.
But the key you said there, the right games at the right time, that's crucial, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Absolutely, and this is why the American Academy of Pediatrics revised their guidelines on screen time a few years ago, because they recognized there are benefits to screens. We live in a digital age, and new social media is important. But there are other things to consider. And while learning is one goal, there's a time for that, and there's also a time for sleep.
Absolutely.
And there's a time for socialization and interaction with others, Dr. Nagels. And if you're on a video game, you're not doing something else, as our first guest mentioned. And teenagers today, I think, spend about 8 hours a day on their screens. So that means they're not interacting with their friends. They're not interacting with their parents. They're not interacting, with other students. What does your research show with regard to that and their socialization skills and how they're impacted by screen time?
So the research in the field suggests that if you have a child who is well plugged into their physical community, you know, to the kids they see every day, then often their time on social media is with those very kids, and that doesn't have to be negative. Again, it depends on what the content of the social media interaction is. However, if you have a child who's not very plugged in to their immediate physical environment, you know, the kids they see in school every day, but is spending more time reaching out to people that, you know, to strangers, that's less advantageous for their general social development.
Yeah, either one of you can answer this question. You see the use of screen time and social media in kids, unlike when I grew up, there's not as much face-to-face engagement with another person. So if you say something that's critical or harmful face-to-face, you oftentimes will see that reaction. The person winces. They may cry. You don't get that on social media. How is that changing the way our children and teens interact with one another?
Dr. Hale, do you want to jump in first?
I don't have a the answer to that, but I agree it's a very important question and aspect of social media we need to pay attention to.
Dr. Negus, what about you?
So the research there, I would say, is still out because, you know, it's still in need of more definitive findings because more of the research has been on how does that child feel? Do they, the degree to which they feel depressed or do they feel very plugged into their current community? And as I said before, that depends on how plugged in they already are to their current community. The degree right. to which the social media interaction actually affects, you know, if you were to bring in two kids and put them in a room and see how do they interact, that research is still being done. And I don't think we have definitive findings on it.
So we really don't know whether they become less empathetic, more tolerant of violence, less tolerant of violence. We haven't gotten any definitive information on that.
Well, as far as the violence goes, it's been well known for years and was recently replicated that children who engage in more violent video games have a bigger predilection for violent aggressive actions, aggressive thoughts, less pro-social activities. And that's both in the laboratory and in self-report. So the violence part we know about. But the other side of the coin, the degree to which if you engaged in more pro-social games, does that help you in your pro-social activities outside of the outside of digital media, that's what hasn't been done so much.
So I guess many parents would say, you know, you say it's essential that the young people are engaged in their community, and that's the way you kind of offset the negative effects. But many parents would say, I can't get them to stop looking at their phone. And if we start this when they're babies, they're going to be so conditioned to want to look at that screen first and foremost before they reach out to a person in their community, that is just going to snowball with time.
Indeed. You know, it's another source of input, as it were, and it can be helpful, but in smaller doses. The contingent responding in person is what's key to all kind of learning.
So in other words, to really learn, you have to be fully present in the environment. Clarify that for us.
Well, okay. So there was a very cool study done in developmental psychology a couple of years ago by Hirsch-Pasek's group down at Temple, where they were looking at preschoolers who were being taught words by their parents, and the parents were texted messages at various points in between the teaching process. And the finding was that the parents whose text messages were interrupted during the teaching process had the kids who did not learn the words so well, whereas the parents whose texting, you know, and these were text messages coming from the researchers, whose text messages came on either side of the word learning process, those kids learned the words. So the children, you know, were observing that their parents were not responding to them contingently when they were trying to learn. And so they didn't learn. And these were 3 and 4-year-olds.
Mm. All right.
So this is a message for parents as well as children.
Yes.
Parents need to take the time to put their phones down and be a role model for their children and be present with them. You know, I focus mostly on evening time, dinner, and pre-bedtime, but it sounds like throughout the day as well,
yes.
So they can help their children learn and grow.
I want to thank both of you for joining us today on The Full Story, and we're going to continue our conversation on screen time and its impact on our young people. We'll take a break, and we'll be back. And welcome back to The Full Story. I'm Rebecca Saran in for Ron Ropiak. Today we're talking about all the screen time our kids take in and what kind of an impact that has on their minds and their brain development. Back with us right now is Dr. Letitia Nagel. She's a professor of psychological sciences at UConn, director of UConn's cognitive science program, and director of UConn's developmental program, and head of UConn Kids. Now joining us as well is Dr. Jennifer Pleasure, clinical psychologist in Fairfield, Connecticut. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Dr. Nagel, just to kind of wrap up what we had talked about in the last segment, the takeaway is screen time isn't necessarily bad time for kids. And in fact, if handled, managed, timed properly, it can be quite a good thing for them. Is that right?
Yes, it can be beneficial. It can help them academically. It can help them, cognitively. So yes, as long as it's managed and the screen time is educational in a variety of ways, then it's not necessarily bad. Although maybe not doing it at right before bedtime is still a good thing to keep in mind.
Right. Let's talk about the little ones, the 0 to 6. Dr. Pleasure, what have you seen in your career? Because I'm fascinated when I'm out in a park or I'm in a restaurant and mm-hmm. I will see a mm-hmm. 2-year-old mm-hmm. with a screen.
Right.
And
right.
looking like they're using it like
right.
they're 25.
I always say, if you don't know how to fix your cell phone, ask the youngest person in the room because they'll probably know. It does start very, very early. Kids are using these tools for various purposes. And I would say that in general, I would agree with Dr. Nagel's. I think that, as well as Dr. Hale, but in that I am sort of what I would call a moderate in relation to this topic, as well as, honestly, most topics related to parenting. I think that parents, especially arguably, but especially in the higher socioeconomic strata today, are bombarded with messages that they're doing things wrong. Mm. And what I see a lot of is parents who need some gentle guidance, the old Dr. Spock advice, trust yourself, you know more than you think. And to coordinate with the recommendations of most pediatricians, that there is no one-size-fits-all answer to this. That every family really needs to figure out what works best for their child and for the entire family.
And it's going to be interesting in the next decades or so, we're going to see this transition. Up until now, there have been the parents who've always been late to the game with technology and the kids.
Sure.
But eventually, it's going to even out. And everybody's going to know how to use the technology equally. And does that mean we're going to have more gentle reminders of mom and dad to put that screen, their own screens down?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that to agree with both Dr. Hale and Dr. Nagel's, modeling, that is to say parental behavior, is by far the most effective teaching tool for every aspect of development. You know, children do as you do. They don't do as you say. So one of the most powerful things a parent can do to moderate their child's use of digital media is to moderate their own use of digital media.
And speaking of modeling, we haven't talked about the verbal side to screens. Mm-hmm. I know that they're interactive, but there's a lot of passive activity that goes on. And not a lot of it is verbal engagement. How is that impacting verbal development in young people 0 to 6?
I would not
say that so much.
Go ahead, please.
I think we need to keep in mind that there are a number of games and apps out there that are actually much more interactive, and those are the ones that are supporting language development. So the games, the apps that are asking the child to generate responses rather than just passive viewing, the ones that keep the child engaged, you know, for longer periods of time rather than just jumping from one thing to another, the ones that are meaningful, you know, that add on to their existing knowledge rather than taking them to some, you know, something brand new, and the ones that are especially socially interactive, as in you play this game with you know, maybe your sibling, maybe your parent, maybe your babysitter, but you play this game with somebody else, those are the ones that actually facilitate verbal development and language development.
So back to you, Dr. Yes. Pleasure, your parents not only have to limit time, limit their own time, mm-hmm. but also really have to know the content of what they're giving their child.
Right. And that's been true since the beginning, I would say.
Since television,
absolutely. Exactly. One of the wonderful things about Sesame Street was that it included humor that was geared toward the parents. If you watch the show, it's hilarious. And the reason for that was to encourage parents to sit and watch the show with their children. So ideally, with all digital media, I like Dr. Nagel's point about having interaction with peers, and certainly at an older age group, that's definitely something that happens, I know, in my own household. But additionally, with younger children, to have a caregiver mediating the child's experience with mm-hmm. the digital media, I think changes the effect and the usefulness of it completely.
And Dr. Nagels, our first guest on the program today, talked about more times than not, content that is on screens moves at a much faster pace than the real world does. Therefore, the child or the teen who takes it in is kind of expecting that visual reward in the real world, and that's not the way the real world works. Therefore, they're disappointed, perhaps, you know, frustrated, angered by that. What is your analysis, or perhaps maybe you've come across this in your research?
I would like to put a different spin on that, that especially, again, has to do with whether the child is actively involved. So if something is going by very quickly, but the child, you know, as in a video game, I'm thinking more school age range at this point, a video game where the child can control the level of difficulty, where the child can control what they're looking at, those kinds of video games actually promote things like cognitive control and working memory because the child is working at it. You know, they're actively involved. However, I think you may be right if all of the content is just going by without any control from the child at all, then A, they're probably not learning very much about it, and B, they are getting a different sense that the world, of how quickly the world moves.
And Dr. Pleasure, here we are in the summertime, and anybody mm-hmm. who grew up in the, you know, before the 1980s,
sure.
the summertime, you kind of had to make your own experiences.
Right.
I mean, it was Camp Mom.
Yeah,
you maybe didn't even go to camp. You
right.
went outside all day and you had to figure
right.
out what to
That's
do.
That's what I mean. Right.
Yeah, and you said, I'm so bored. But it forced you to think creatively.
Absolutely.
If you have access to screens all the time and this content has been designed and created and maybe you're engaging in it, but you're not creating that program.
Mm-hmm.
How is it impacting our children and their level of creativity?
Creativity. You know, I think as Dr. Nagels pointed out, there is some digital media that is a wonderful tool to inspire creativity. There are artistic programs where children can learn how to do photography, different kinds of artwork using digital tools. They can create films themselves, mm-hmm. which many of them do. I mean, that is creative. Honestly, think about Vines, which were so popular a couple of years ago, the 6-second videos that kids were making. How do you pack in a joke or something that people are going to want to see and design it and carry it out and film it and post it up there? Additionally, I think that the use of digital tools inspires in many children an interest in learning how to code and create their own content.
Yes.
But something I would like to say that I kept coming back to when I was considering this topic was that one of the important underlying factors that affects how children consume digital media and the effect that it has on them is socioeconomics. I think we've been talking a lot, sort of inadvertently, about people in the upper socioeconomic levels
right.
in our country. And there was a New York Times article in October of 2018 by Nellie Bowles that documented how the pendulum sort of swung from access to technology being a status symbol. Think about the wealthier school districts that first had computers and smart boards in the classrooms, and those students had computers at home, to today, when some of the wealthiest members of our society are going screen-free in their houses and their children only play with wooden blocks, you know. Now, too much screen time has become sort of an indication of less wealth and less power. So a big part of this, you know, additionally, I would say for young children, I'm always thinking in terms of common sense. As I said, have the parent trust him or herself. But a big part of how much screen time and what quality of screen time their children have access to depends on the resources that the parents have. And that is both internal and external resources. A very, very stressed parent who doesn't have the funds to hire someone to take their child to the local public library, which is also well-funded because they live in a wealthy area, you know, may end up parking their child in front of whatever they have available, their phone or whatever they have available, so that they can have some bandwidth, to use a internet term.
Well, what are your thoughts on that, Dr. Nagels, about the socioeconomic differences when it comes to screen time?
So, so I think that you're spot on that there are some in the higher, I mean, we've read about these in the higher SES who have realized too much screen time is not going to be helping the child, especially right before bed. Whereas we've always had challenges across, in the lower SES bandwidth with childcare,
right.
And I think this is simply a reflection of that. If you don't have access to good quality childcare in all of the ways that are needed, then what you fall back on is less good in all of the in many relevant ways, including with digital media.
And
so
too much screen time too.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what are your thoughts about, as we were talking a moment ago with Dr. Pleasure, about creativity? I know that there are art programs, there's filmmaking programs, but in general, in terms of you yourself having to write and create the app or something out of nothing, as opposed to being given a template that you work within, creating something out of nothing that you have to come up with the entire concept. You don't get that really with using an iPad or a computer per se, do you?
Well, it depends on what the nothing is. And I mean, I was talking to a 9-year-old just yesterday who is spending part of her summer coding her own videos. So she is doing something that's very creative, and she was telling us about all of the videos that she was creating. The degree to which that's based on a template, well, you know, when you are first, you know, building blocks, you know, mom first stacks them up, and then you say, huh, I'll stack them up that way too, and then maybe I'll stack them up a different way. So, you know, in many ways, we always provide scaffolds for our kids in their play. I would like to say, though, that one aspect that digital media is crowding out, and it's maybe not be the creativity so much, but it's the outside time.
I was just going to ask you about that.
Things play outside.
Or the lack of
to learn the trees and the smells and the flowers and the bugs in direct, they may get to read about them, or engage with them on the digital media, but they're not getting to roll in the grass and smell the flowers.
You don't get the full sensory experience, do you, when it comes to nature? I mean, you can watch, what's going on in the rainforest or what's going on in the Great Barrier Reef, but you're not swimming in the water.
Right.
You're not, as you said, smelling the flowers. And Dr. Pleasure, how is that letting our children down in terms of brain development with not providing them with that sensory experience and also not providing them with the opportunity to really understand nature, therefore they become good stewards in the future?
Yeah, that's clearly sort of a problem in our culture generally, I think, is that so much of the way we live our lives here today prevents us from having the leisure time and having access to nature and going out and enjoying it as much as would be healthy for all of us, and that especially goes for young children. And I think that's sort of where I start with all this, is digital media can be a useful tool given a child has additionally loving relationships, access to their environment, indoor and outdoor, in a safe place where they can explore that. All of that is really more important to a child's development, especially the relationships, what Dr. Nagel's called the contingent response in person. All of that is much more formative. And I think that digital media can fit into a healthy development. But again, that parents need some guidance and also need to trust their common sense in terms of setting limits.
And very, very, very briefly, Dr. Nagels, age to get a cell phone, what's your recommendation?
To get a cell phone, 10.
10? What about you, Dr. Pleasure?
Age to get a cell phone?
Yeah.
We gave our children in my family simple flip phones that could only be used to make phone calls in middle school when they were going to be away from us without an alternative way to contact us.
Well, we've talked about a lot today. It's a lot to be a parent in today's world. I want to thank you both and the rest of our guests for joining us today as we look at the impact of digital media on the developing minds and brains of our young people today. You've been listening to The Full Story. I'm Rebecca Saran, filling in for Ron Ropiak. We'll see you next time.